Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
South Korea has reached an agreement with North Korea to have the leaders of both countries meet for a summit on April 27th. Officials said South Korean President Moon Jae-in will meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the border village of Panmunjom. The announcement came Thursday after high-level talks between the two sides in Panmunjom. Panmunjom is a truce village that sits within a demilitarized area separating the two Koreas. A statement released by the two countries said officials from North and South Korea plan to meet again on April 4th to discuss details for the summit. The April 27th meeting will be the third summit ever held between leaders of the two Koreas since the 1950-53 Korean War. One of the summits happened in 2000, the other in 2007. In 1945, the Korean Peninsula was divided into a U.S.-dominated South and Soviet Union-backed North. North Korea and South Korea became independent nations in 1948. South Korea's unification minister told reporters Thursday that an important part of the summit will be setting up discussions between the leaders on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The minister said both sides would continue to hold working-level discussions centering on issues surrounding the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, the stabilization of peace, and the development of relations between the South and North. The head of North Korea's delegation said before Thursday's talks that the past 80 days had been filled with unprecedented historic events between the two countries. He expressed hope that the summit would meet his nation's desire for peace on the Korean Peninsula. The latest talks followed a surprise meeting this week in Beijing between Kim Jong-un and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Official Chinese news reports said Kim agreed in talks with Xi to discuss denuclearization. Tension was high in the area last year after North Korea carried out repeated tests of nuclear weapons and missiles. But the tension decreased in recent months after the North halted the tests and took part in the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Kim is also set to hold a summit meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump sometime before the end of May. The time and place for that meeting have not yet been announced. I'm Brian Lynn.
A man in the state of Michigan is free this week after being wrongly convicted of murder and spending 45 years in prison. A judge has agreed to permanently drop the case against the man. Richard Phillips is 71 years old. He said of his release that the criminal justice system works. It just didn't work fast enough. A lawyer for Michigan's Wayne County, Kim Worthy, said a new investigation by her office supported Phillips' claim that he had no role in the shooting death of Gregory Harris in 1971. She said a key witness lied during the trial in 1972. Worthy said, "There's nothing I can say to bring back 40 years of his life." The case was reopened at the urging of the Innocence Clinic, part of the University of Michigan's law school. It made the request after the co-defendant in the 1972 trial told the state's parole board in 2010 that Phillips was not involved in the crime. The co-defendant also said the key witness who lied during the trial helped him kill Harris. The Innocence Clinic began working with Phillips on his case in 2014. He had been freed on bond since December 2017 and was expected to get a new trial this year. But the judge's ruling this week means he does not need a second trial. Judge Kevin Cox told Phillips, "You have seen the worst and best of the criminal justice system." David Moran is director of the Innocence Clinic. He said, "No one in the United States has ever served more time in prison before being freed than Phillips." "His freedom truly belongs to him again," Moran said. When asked about his years in prison, Phillips told reporters, "I've never carried bitterness around, so I'm not a bitter man." As a free man, one of Phillips' goals is to reunite with his two children. They were just 2 and 4 years old when he went to prison in 1972. Phillips said he has not heard from them and does not know where they live. Phillips has settled in an area just outside of Detroit. He attends a church where he shares his story with others.
It is no surprise that many popular love songs use conditionals. Conditional sentences show that something is true only when something else is true. So they help us talk about wishes, hopes, and even regrets. In her song, All the Way, classic American jazz singer Billie Holiday sings about love. She uses the word unless to show a condition.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless he loves you.
The word unless means if not. When Holiday says it's no good unless they love you all the way, she means a romance is not good if the person does not love you completely. On a past Everyday Grammar program, we told you about conditionals that use the word if. For example, if I practice enough, I can speak English. But in today's program, we will tell you about other words and phrases we use to make conditionals in spoken English. First, let's quickly go over how conditionals work. Conditional sentences have two parts: the conditional clause, which shows the condition, and the main clause, which shows the result. For example, if I practice enough is a conditional clause, and I can speak English is the main clause. Conditional clauses are not complete sentences. They need a main clause to be complete. There are a few types of conditionals. Some show possible situations, like the sentence about speaking English. Some show improbable situations, and others show situations that are impossible or very unrealistic. You can learn more about this in our past program. Now, let's continue with unless. In our Billie Holiday example, unless they love you all the way is the conditional clause. It shows the condition. And it's no good is the main clause. It shows the result of the condition. Some English learners have a habit of putting the words unless and if together as unless if, but these words should not be used together. Two more words that express the same idea as unless are otherwise and or. Each word means if not. So unless, or, otherwise, and if not have the same basic meaning. Keep in mind that or and otherwise also have other meanings. But in conditional statements, they mean if not. In his song Trouble Loves Me, British singer Morrissey uses the word otherwise to talk about unreturned love. The conditional clause is otherwise hold me, and the main clause is so console me. Notice that his conditional and main clauses use the imperative form, so the subject you is not stated but is understood. The word otherwise sometimes uses a different sentence structure in conditionals. Here's an example. The plane must be delayed, otherwise she would have called. In this example, the clauses are separate sentences. More importantly, even though the clause otherwise she would have called contains the conditional word, it does not state the condition. The condition is the plane must be late. Having the condition appear in a separate sentence or clause is common with otherwise and or. Listen to an example using or. Finish your lunch or you can't play outside. Here the condition is finish your lunch, and the result is you can't play outside. You'll notice that the result clause, not the conditional clause, contains the conditional word or. Let's move on to the phrase in case. We use in case to talk about things we should do to prepare for other things that may happen. For example, I'll bring an umbrella in case it rains. In this sentence, I don't know if it will rain or not, but it's possible. Now listen to the same sentence with if. I'll bring an umbrella if it rains. Did you get the difference in meaning? In the if sentence, I'll wait to see if it rains first, then I'll bring an umbrella. Another usage for in case is mainly for signs about what to do if danger occurs. The structure of the conditional clause is in case of plus a noun. For example, in case of emergency, break glass. Our last conditional phrase for today is as long as. When we begin a conditional clause with as long as, the statement is a little stronger than using if. As long as essentially means only if. In his song called As Long As You Love Me, American pop singer Justin Bieber says that his love can survive any difficulty. Because this is a song, it doesn't follow standard sentence structure. Here, the conditional clause is as long as you love me, and the other lines are main clauses. One important note about conditionals is that you can often switch the placement of main and conditional clauses and get the same meaning. For example, I'll bring an umbrella in case it rains means the same as in case it rains, I'll bring an umbrella. And if you learn conditionals, you'll have a lot more freedom to express yourself in English. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On April 9, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Union General Ulysses Grant. Within weeks, the Civil War would be over. When people in Washington learned of Lee's surrender, they hurried to the White House. The crowd wanted to hear from President Abraham Lincoln. The speech he gave would be one of his last, as Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe explained in our series.
President Lincoln spoke several days after General Lee's surrender. The people expected a victory speech, but Lincoln gave them something else. Already, he was moving forward from victory to the difficult times ahead. The Southern Rebellion was over. Now, he faced the task of rebuilding the Union. Lincoln did not want to punish the South. He wanted to rejoin the ties that the Civil War had broken. So, when the people of the North expected a speech of victory, he gave them a speech of reconstruction instead. On the night of April 11th, Lincoln appeared before a crowd outside the White House. He held a candle in one hand and his speech in the other.
Fellow citizens, Lincoln said, we meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart. The surrender of the main army of the Confederacy gives hope of a righteous and speedy peace. The joy cannot be held back. By these recent successes, we have had pressed more closely upon us the question of reconstruction. We all agree, Lincoln continued, that the so-called seceded states are out of their correct relation with the Union. We also agree that what the government is trying to do is get these states back into their correct relation. I believe it is not only possible, but in fact easier, to do this without deciding the legal question of whether these states have ever been out of the Union. Finding themselves safely at home, it would be of no importance whether they had ever been away.
There was cheering and applause when President Lincoln finished, but less than when he began. The speech had been too long and too detailed to please the crowd. Lincoln, however, believed it a success. He hoped he had made the country understand one thing: the great need to forget hatred and bitterness in the difficult time of rebuilding that would follow the war. The president continued to discuss his ideas on Reconstruction over the next few days. On Friday, April 14th, he agreed to put this work aside for a while. In the afternoon, he took his wife, Mary, for a long drive away from the city. In the evening, they would go to the theater.
One of the popular plays of the time, called Our American Cousin, was being performed at Ford's Theater, not far from the White House. The Secretary of War did not want the Lincolns to go alone. He ordered an army officer to go with them. The President and Mrs. Lincoln sat in special seats at Ford's Theater. The presidential box was above and to one side of the stage. A guard always stood outside the door to the box. On this night, however, the guard did not remain. He left the box unprotected.
President Lincoln settled down in his seat to enjoy the play. As he did so, a man came to the door of the box. He carried a gun in one hand and a knife in the other. The man entered the presidential box quietly. He slowly raised the gun. He aimed it at the back of Lincoln's head. He fired. Then the man jumped from the box to the stage, 3 meters below. Many in the theater recognized him. He was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he hit the stage floor, but he pulled himself up, shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus ever to tyrants, and ran out the door. He got on a horse and was gone.
The attack was so quick that the audience did not know what had happened. Then a woman shouted, "The president has been shot." Lincoln had fallen forward in his seat, unconscious. Someone asked if it was possible to move him to the White House. A young army doctor said no. The president's wound was terrible. He would die long before reaching the White House. So Lincoln was moved to a house across the street from Ford's Theater. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from the president's head. He could not. Nothing could be done except wait. The end was only hours away.
Cabinet members began to arrive, while wild reports spread through the city. The Confederates had declared war again. There was fighting in the streets. An official of the War Department described the situation. The extent of the plot was unknown. From so horrible a beginning, what might come next? How far would the bloody work go? The safety of Washington must be looked after. The people must be told. The assassin and his helpers must be captured.
Early the next morning, April 15th, Abraham Lincoln died. A prayer was said over his body. His eyes were closed. The news went out by telegraph to cities and towns across the country. People read the words but could not believe them. To millions of Americans, Abraham Lincoln's death was a personal loss. They had come to think of him as more than the President of the United States. He was a trusted friend. People hung black cloth on their doors in sorrow. Even the South mourned for Lincoln, its former enemy. Southern General Joe Johnston said, "Mr. Lincoln was the best friend we had. His death is the worst thing that could happen for the South."
Messages of regret came from around the world. British labor groups said they could never forget the things Lincoln had said about working people, things such as, "The strongest tie of human sympathy should be one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues." A group representing hundreds of French students sent this message: "In President Lincoln, we mourn a fellow citizen. There are no longer any countries shut up in narrow frontiers. Our country is everywhere where there are neither masters nor slaves. Wherever people live in liberty or fight for it, we look to the other side of the ocean to learn how a people which has known how to make itself free knows how to preserve its freedom." The assassination of Abraham Lincoln touched the imagination of America's writers. Many tried to put their feelings into words. Walt Whitman wrote several poems of mourning. Here is part of one of them: "O Captain, my Captain."
"Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead."
Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the spring. That is the time of year when lilac plants burst into flower throughout much of the United States. One of Walt Whitman's most beautiful poems in honor of Lincoln is called "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed." Here is part of that poem:
"When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac, blooming perennial and drooping star in the west, and thought of him I love. Coffin that passes through lanes and streets, through day and night with the great cloud darkening the land, with the countless torches lit, with the silent sea of faces and the unbared heads, with the tolling, tolling bell's perpetual clang. Here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.